97. This is Kelly Elaine Mavies. I am at 339 Henderson Street in Oxford, North Carolina with
James Eddie McCoy. I'm at 339 Henderson Street, Oxford, North Carolina, which is my mother's house.
Yes. And this is our second interview. We had an interview about 1 month ago where we discussed mainly your work and what motivated you to do become an oral historian and the different strategies and approaches that you use. Today I want to talk a little bit more about your life, James Eddie McCoy, how you grew up, what it was like growing up in Oxford, a little bit about race relations and so on and so forth. So let's back up and go back into the childhood. But first, let me ask you, how are you feeling today?
I'm okay. Just busy. We've been running all morning, but otherwise, okay.
What have you been doing?
Well, I'm trying to get back in my house from a house fire. I got cobblers and contractors and electricians. I'm just overseeing to make sure everything's okay today.
Yeah, the house is coming along nicely, though. It's going to be really beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to being invited over when it's all fixed up.
The next time you come, we'll be in my house, hopefully.
Okay. Let me ask you, what was your father's occupation when you were growing up?
My father was just, when he was growing up, he worked at a printing office, and he worked with round machines and ran a press and different. That's what he did. And by having six children, he had a part-time job at the factory. We have a tobacco factory, and it's a season work. And they worked from September to about January or February, mm-hmm. or March, depending on how big the season. So he worked two jobs doing that.
So he did a printing press. What was the name of the printing press?
It was Cobra Printing Company. They did all the publishing of books and pamphlets and different things for the city of Oxford. And that was the only one here.
Hmm. And working at a tobacco factory as well.
Yeah, he worked in where they make the barrels, where they shipping out tobacco. He worked in a place where they called a Cooper shop. Mm. That's where they made barrels. It's like a cobbler shop.
Right.
You have to know what you're doing to make the barrels. Mm.
So when did he begin to own the pool hall?
Well, first my father came from the orphanage here. We're a black orphanage. He came in 1921 mm. when he was about 3 years old. And he worked at stayed at the orphanage, and you could stay back then when you got 18 if you didn't have anywhere to go, no relatives. And you could board there and work out. And what he did, when he was growing up, he used to work called Waller Boarding House, it was a boarding house. He used to get in wood and work around there. And then when he finished or left the orphanage, he went there regular for a while, full time. Mm-hmm. And that's how he got to learn people in town.
Mm-hmm. So when did he decide to buy the pool hall? Guys own the pool hall, right?
Yeah, but then my father worked at, we had a place in Vance County called Tungsten Mine, mm-hmm. where they made tungsten, they got rocks they put in the light bulbs.
Right.
And he worked there and worked in the factory, and he worked two jobs. And then my brother used to like to go to the pool hall all the time when he was a kid, slept there. And so my father told him, he asked my father, he wanted to buy a pool hall or something. He wanted to ask my father, why don't he help him buy a pool hall? But that was just a dream. My father, a friend of my father's, had been in a long time and worn out of it. And my brother was coming of 18, he had to be 18, and I was already. And so what happened was that he finally got the opportunity to buy one. He was working for the county as a janitor. And then my father bought a pool hall in 59.
So you were almost grown then.
Oh yeah. I was 18. Yeah.
Right. So that wasn't something that was going on while you were growing up or anything like that. Okay, I see. So most of your life, he did the two or three jobs.
Yeah. My father always worked two or three jobs.
Right. I understand. So and your mother, you've already mentioned in the previous interview that she was a domestic and mm-hmm. that she worked in the house that you ended up buying.
Yeah, my mother was a maid in the house that I lived in, that I bought. Mm-hmm.
Okay, after a brief interruption, let's try and pick this conversation back up. we were discussing the occupations of your parents. I think what we...
My mother.
We had gotten to your mother. Your mother working as a maid in various households.
Mm-hmm.
Did she work for one family primarily or different families?
My mother worked for different families. The most wealthiest people in the town. Mm-hmm. She was did catering and served parties and weddings and stuff like that.
Oh, I see.
And cooked all the time.
She wasn't the kind that stayed there. She came home every
night. No, she came home every night. No, she had six children.
Yeah. Well, because I know some people, my great aunt, for example, she was more like a live-in.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yeah. Huh. So she didn't get to come home except for on weekends and that kind of thing. So, how did you feel about that when you were growing up?
Well, when we was growing up, we was in a situation where it was only four blacks on a street that caught in a white neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that was a situation where the kids were staggered. They was older than we were. So you had to go outside your neighborhood. And so we only played with white kids because that was the neighborhood we was surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't go but so far away from home. And when you're 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, you couldn't go 5 or 6 a half a mile away from home to play with kids. And so that's who we played when we came home from school in the afternoon, most of the white kids that my mother that knew us in the neighborhood.
So what was that like, playing with white kids in the neighborhood?
Well, you don't know because it's funny, I always been integrated. I grew up integrated, didn't know I was in an integrated neighborhood, but actually I was integrated. And it's, you don't know because as a kid you come up with it.
Right. Well, what about your schools? Were those integrated also?
The two different things we didn't do is go to school and go to church together.
Right.
And so, see, we didn't go to beach with them, but because we thought they were rich, you know, that's who go to beach is white people. We didn't know black people go to beach when we was kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that was only different. We know we couldn't go to their school,
right.
But we did everything else together.
So your schools were integrated all throughout, through elementary through high school?
Right.
Were your teachers mostly black or white?
See, everything was segregated. It was black.
So all the teachers were black also?
All the black teachers was black and everything.
Hmm. What was that experience like going to a segregated school?
See, segregated schools, I learned a lot about segregated schools because I was always into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I got into things. And when you get into trouble, you learn more about segregated schools than you does when you're a good kid. See, you think where you was raised at, it's as if the janitor was sick, who you think, you couldn't call a superintendent office and say, hey, the janitor's out sick today, or he gonna be out for 2 weeks, or he gonna be out for such and such a days. You just, if you got caught for smoking or you was in trouble, that's who fired the boiler, that's who cleaned the school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that's the jobs they gave you to do when you got in trouble at school.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this school situation where you had all black students and all black teachers, were all the students treated the same by the teachers?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Okay, this is crazy. This you wouldn't believe this. If you're light-skinned, the teacher would treat you different than she would the dark-skinned kid.
Really?
Yeah, they would. But all of my teachers now, all the teachers that I had was here, lived here in Oxford. Except two. So we see them in the grocery store or at my church or in the street after school. So they always knew our family or they went to some church. But see, the school, if you was light-skinned, they treated you different because you're supposed to have been smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And they would set you, you sat at the front of the class.
Really?
Yeah, we had one teacher one day, I wasn't in this class. Her name was Mrs. Brunner. They always said she was kind of crazy. But Mrs. Brunner stopped the class one day. She was teaching math. And told the kids, I'm going to show you the difference between black and white. And told the kid to go over to the gym and tell the coach to send some cotton balls and alcohol. And this dark-skinned girl ran around with this light-skinned girl saying, I'm going to show you the difference between black and white. And what she did, took cotton and put alcohol and rubbed the alcohol on the light-skinned girl and said, you see, you don't get no color, don't nothing come off. But when she rubbed it on the black girl, she rubbed it. See, you see this come off. See how dirt come off black people, off of black.
She did that in class?
Uh-huh. And my friends was in the class, and they laughed.
So did those two girls ever hang out together again?
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah, back then, you know, it was, you know, you thought the teacher was crazy. You know, you didn't.
My goodness. So since you weren't really light skinned, what did they teach you in class?
I did a lot of talking. They put you in the back.
Yeah.
When you do a lot of talking and stuff like that, they and the, what they call disturbing the class, they put you in the back. Mm-hmm. Or if they put you in the back, and they still teach us like teaching you around your red line, and you don't know. And they put you in the back where you're back there, you can kind of do what you want to do, and they teach to the kids up front, mm-hmm. and don't reach the kids in the back. But we listened, we knew, we, you know what's going on.
So did the kids in the front and the kids in the back play together socially?
Yeah, we played together. You didn't have no choice. You're from the same neighborhood.
So you played together on recess and that type of thing?
Yeah.
So you didn't have, it wasn't that separated, just in the classroom?
Just in the classroom.
And so as you grew older in this town, did the situation stay the same?
It just stays the same.
Yeah.
Now, the hardest part about it is that when you got a book, we had five or six names in it. And when you read the names, you knew they weren't black kids because, you know, everybody knew everybody. And you get your books from the white kids. And when our books came after the books had started getting raggedy. And they would hand them down. Now, we always had hand-me-down books. Now, unless your parents could afford to buy you new books.
Right. So how did that make you feel?
Well, I always was a strong individual. Mm-hmm. And I always stayed in trouble. And I grew up as always taking charge and being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to books and other things, I wasn't an A student. But I always was people, I could lead people that was very smart. And you know.
So did it bother you all that you were getting these hand-me-down books?
Well, we didn't have no choice.
Yeah.
The only thing I said, how you thinking I learned? You give me a book that's 3 and 4 years old. Why should you think I should be on that level that you're on and my books and all my material? I'm 3 or 4 years behind.
Right.
And then I'm a slow student too. So look how far they put that put me.
Did you really think you were a slow student at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why? Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Why?
At school I was. Because that's where you separate you. Mm-hmm. They put you in the back.
So because the teacher put you in the back, you kind of accepted that.
Yeah, that's where they put
right.
They put the smart students on the front row and then the next on the second, and they segregate they as you the smarter you start from the front and the dumb as always was in the back. Mm-hmm. So you could keep noise. So I sat back there because I could keep noise mm-hmm. and could do talk and do like I wanted to.
So if you can think back, did you think that, you know, when you were a child, did you think that things would change in terms of race relations in Oxford and between light-skinned and dark-skinned black people?
No. You never think about that.
You didn't think about it at all?
Mm-mm.
Or you thought it would stay the same?
You accepted. You thought it would always stay the same because your parents, no one in your house will tell you things going to get better.
So you never heard that?
I never heard that.
What kind of things did your parents tell you about race and race relations?
Respect white people and do what they say and don't talk bad.
You heard that from both sides?
My mother more than my father. Mm-hmm. See, because my father grew up in an orphanage, so he didn't come up around white people no way until he got of age of 13, 14, 15 or 16 where he could come work out. My mother come up around in that environment.
So what would your dad say? Can you remember?
He would always tell me to do a good job. That's all he wanted me to do.
Yeah.
If I rake leaves good. If I work flowers good. I used to clean for a lady. She had a maid, but she believed in me and cleaning. That was right, moving furniture. Anything I did, my father always wanted to make sure I did it right and did a good job.
So do a good job, whatever you're doing.
Right.
So I know you followed your mother's advice.
Yeah, but I knew my mother was my mother was sold on white people. She believed that it was everything was the law. What they say, which you know, she believed that. I questioned the law because of that. That's the kind of kid I was at school. I was always in the thing, mischievous.
So you were already questioning it at a young age?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I questioned it in my mind.
So I guess your mama didn't like that very much, huh?
No, she didn't like it very much, but I always questioned why they had to be right. Why was they always this? Why were white people had to be right? Why, well, you know, I just questioned it.
Is this something that you could ever discuss within the classroom?
Oh, no, no, no. Those black teachers wouldn't have that because they'd lose their job.
Well, what did they teach y'all about race in school?
Nothing much. Very little they taught us about race in school. What we learned that we had to be better when we go out of, in life than a white kid. That's the only thing they taught us, that we had to be better. But how to be better, they left that up to us more or less than all they know to teach us math and reading and regular, you know. But for us, they always talk about the challenge of life once we leave school.
I'm really curious about this part because you don't hear that much about segregated education. My dad taught me a little bit about his experience, but he only went to segregated schools for the first part. Then he moved to Detroit when he was around 10, and they were already integrated in Detroit. But he told me a little bit about it. But I wanted to ask you, what kind of American history did you learn?
History?
Yeah, did you get any black history or anything like that in school?
I ain't know. The only thing that after I got grown and got into politics and went back and studied history, and I went back and studied history. My whole life was, after I got to the military and found out where I was smart and where I fitted in, I had to go back and re-educate my whole self. At 22, I was in college, and I went to service at 22. And I went to service for 2 years, and then I started back re-educated in myself over again. Mm-hmm. And all I ever known, the teacher taught me the difference between Republican and Democrat. That's the only thing I ever learned in class, I guess because I was in the back. You know,
right.
I ain't never knew anything about, you know, they never told us, you didn't even know anything about no black ever done much. Mm-hmm. You heard something a little bit about Jack and Rob or something.
Maybe
Joe Lugg.
Booker T. Washington.
Yeah, Booker T. Washington, that was all.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But half of the teachers didn't know anything about it, so how could they tell the student?
They went through the same
thing. They went through the same thing, too. They didn't know anything.
Yeah. So,
I used to loan money to the teacher, because one of my teachers, agriculture teacher, knew we worked in the afternoon, me and another friend, and they know we made a lot of money in the afternoon, and their check wouldn't like, we didn't know any better, but now their money, they couldn't manage their money, and they used to borrow $5 or $10 from us.
So where would you get the money from?
I worked in the afternoon.
Oh.
I learned early how to hustle and how to
Where'd you work?
Worked for these white people and stuff like that. I knew how much I was worth. Now, I always knew how much I was worth per hour. And I knew, you know, I knew that.
So what were you doing?
Exactly? Working the flowers, getting in wood and stuff like that.
And how much would you make per hour?
Probably 50 cents, 75 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. Sometimes 15 cents an hour, depending on how much money we need.
And how old were you when you started doing that kind of work?
Oh, I was 10. I was working at 10. I started around 6 or 7. My parents started teaching me how to work around 6 or 7. When I got 10 years old, I could work.
Did you want to work?
Oh, yeah, I love money. They brought me up to love money.
Yeah.
If you love money, you'll always be successful in life. And I tell you another thing, what made me success. My friends, we was paper boys. And you track the most kids that ever carried delivered newspapers, they always, 90% of them always were successful in life. They had something. I got up, I wrote 86 papers in the morning before I went to school, and I was a dummy. But I could get up and roll 86 papers and carry them in the morning and come back and go to school. And I had half of my lesson and stuff like that. And I could play sports too. But no one never tapped into where I was good at.
You know, you talked a little bit about that. You said that when you got to the surface, that's when they tapped into your skills and your talents.
Yeah.
Right. So from the age of about 10 until throughout high school, you were working after school?
Oh, yeah. Play sports, work.
Sports?
Football, basketball, baseball. I could play any of it. I was good at it, you know. I didn't know why, but I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I made the team, you know. I wouldn't sit on the bench. I was a pretty good athlete all the way around. But see, that's another thing. If I was that good in sports, no teacher never thought I was good in school. You follow what I'm saying?
Right.
They always kept me in the back.
Yeah.
I was always in the back of the classroom.
Right. Always.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what year did you graduate from high school?
In 1960.
In 1960.
That was a rough time.
Yeah?
1960 was a...
Tell me about it.
1960 was a tough year because when in April of 1960, when they first set in, mm-hmm. in Greensboro, that's when my life changed and everything changed in my life about white people and about the world and what was going on. Because we didn't have a television, we had access to a TV, we could read and write, and we could listen, that you could go downtown and you're supposed to be served like everybody else.
Mm.
And that's when my life turned around.
Well, how did you hear about the sit-in?
I always was into things. Now I listen to radio, I was nosy.
So you heard it on the radio?
I heard it on the radio.
Were people talking about it a lot?
Black people was, but they were afraid to talk out about it because mm-hmm. they didn't want you to try.
So when did you guys discuss it, like at night?
In the afternoon after school, we'd be playing basketball on the way home or something. We'd sat down and talk about it on the weekend.
And what was the general feeling? Were people excited? Were the other kids?
You had my friends, we was in. Kids that was in trouble always would try things. So that's who I with. If you're nice and good and A students, good students don't participate in anything. They didn't change they didn't change civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
See, people look, when they talk about civil rights and talk about this, people laid their life on the line was dumb people. People that was ignorant and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't know how much jail time they could get. Or they was laying their life out there and had people smarter getting you to do things like that. But they would not try. They wouldn't dare do it because they had borrowed money from the bank, see. They owed that white man. We didn't owe no white man. Hey, your parents didn't have nothing, so you didn't owe nothing.
Right.
You paid 15 cents a week on a rug. You didn't know nothing about that. If the man, they had a salesman, a blanket man come by. He sell blankets, sell sheets. And what, Philip Brush Man, you heard about that, how old that company. He come by, sell brushes, pots, and pans.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother had paid about a quarter, 50 cents, a dollar a week on stuff.
What was that? I've never heard of the Brush Man. What was that?
Philip Brush.
That was
the one of the populist things out. And that was the first salesman that was in the United States with Philip Brush. That was national.
And what, he sold brushes?
Brushes. I don't know why they call it Philip Brush, but that was the name of the company.
Right.
The pots and pans and different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a national company. Oh, in two or three states, it was a big thing.
So you and your friends were rebellious anyway.
If you're mischievous and you stayed in things, you try things.
Right.
See, because you don't have nobody that's scared. We used to go up a hill from school, and it's a red light at the bottom. And we used to, and the prison trucks, we didn't like, see, I always thought things was wrong. Because I don't know if I had the idea and if I had a chance to have input in something, I would think it was right. But I never had a chance to make a decision or come up with a plan or let's do this or do that. So when the prison trucks would come by down by our school at 5 o'clock bringing the prisoners to carry them to the camp, I didn't like it because the guys are locked up in the back of the trucks and the white man was up front drive and mm-hmm. had guns. So what we want to do was disrupt and make the truck turn over, stop it so the guy helped them get out of prison, out of the trucks. So what we would do is take car ties and we could see the truck coming and it was a warehouse. So we would time it because we had practiced and we would roll ties down and make them put on brakes and hope they could have a wreck where the prisoners could escape.
And did it ever work?
They couldn't see, the tires would roll across in front of them, but they couldn't figure out where the tires was coming from. And sometimes it'd be cars. See, the trucks would be coming one and car, and they would be looking for us, trying to find out where the tires, but they couldn't find us because we were smart.
Right.
We roll the tires and run. By the time the tires get to that intersection, we'd be two blocks over in town, see, mixed in with.
So you never caused the truck to turn over?
No, anyway. But no. We was hoping it would.
Yeah. So 1960, let's get back to that year. Who were your running buddies?
George Lyons and Henry Thorpe. And he had a brother, George had a brother named David. And a friend of mine's Tommy Royster. He had a brother named Butch. He was smarter than we were. He was, because he didn't get into things like we did. And a guy named Leon Robinson, matter of fact, that cobbler back of my house, he lived next door.
The older gentleman.
Uh-huh. Now, my brother was 2 or 3 years under me. He didn't like that kind of, you
what
know.
What was his name?
Henry. Mm-hmm. But he didn't run with me much. My brother sometimes. I had my own group, he had his own group. But the group I had, we was always into something. Because we was paper boys, we worked for white people.
Right.
We did everything. But let me tell you one thing now. We knew early that white people didn't know black, didn't know one black. They couldn't tell you apart. We knew that they thought all blacks look alike. And let me tell you what my friend used to do. He was smart. One day we worked for this white lady. And he said, did you get paid? We said, no, we got to go back to Miss Graysall and them house this afternoon. She going to pay us. He said, what time? We told him. You know, he went and collected our money.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
That was smart, wasn't
yeah.
it?
And that's when we, see, we was 15 and 16. And that's when we knew white people didn't know the difference between us.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them. And we worked for old ladies.
Right. And they couldn't see that good.
Right.
So you've already talked a little bit about this on tape, but let me ask you, you guys were involved in a sit-in.
Oh, yeah.
That year, shortly after the Greensboro sit-in. How soon after was it?
Before school closed. Right. We tried. See, our school closed by May the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
See, we get out of school in June the 5th or June the 10th.
So do you remember the day?
No, I don't remember the day, but I know it was in May.
It was in May.
Because it happened in, college, I think, get out in May.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in Greensboro in April, I think, or 1st of May or whatever.
Right. What was the name of the drugstore?
We went to the 5 and 10 cent store, Woodworth.
And whose idea was it?
I came up with the idea and wanted to know if we try it, you know.
Right.
And they said, we'll try it.
Was it in the papers afterwards?
No.
What you guys did?
No, they wouldn't dare do that. See, then that would give more people an idea, encourage more people.
So it never hit the paper?
It never hit the paper. And if it had, we wouldn't have wanted to know it then because, see, we didn't want the publicity.
Mm-hmm. What about your elders after you guys had done? I mean, you told me all the little details of what happened, but after all that happened and you actually sat in and you guys...
They were scared.
They were scared.
My mother and them. You was bothering white people. They always tell you leave white people alone.
So that no one picked up on it and tried to organize you guys or anything?
Oh, no, you kidding. They'd get killed. They were scared. No, they wouldn't try that.
Right.
No, only fools do things like that.
So I know you went into the service in 1965. What did you do between 1960 and 1965?
I went to live in New York. I didn't like it. I came back and went to college. Because my mother said, well, I was going. If I didn't stay for one day, I gonna prove to her that I won't go on, but I stayed out, tried working and stuff like that.
So you went to New York right out of high school?
Yeah, but see, we've been going to Wildwood, New Jersey. See, kids that lived in Oxford went away for the summer to work to make money to go to school.
Where?
You didn't make enough money on the farm. Wildwood is next to Atlantic City. Some children went to Atlantic City, the hotels and work and cook.
So back up, honey. So there were summers when you had been to New Jersey to work?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
my baby brother came up and my baby sister, they grew up in Wildwood.
And what'd you do in New Jersey?
They work. Cook.
What kind of work?
They do the chambermaid, my sister's name. You wash dishes.
What'd you do when you were there?
I wash dishes and cook. You want to be a cook because you make more money you can eat.
Mm-hmm.
And you save
for
money.
Who? Private homes or restaurants?
No, restaurants.
Oh, okay. So you had been to the North already?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you had been to New York probably?
Yeah.
During those summer times?
Yeah.
When you were back working during those summers, were you allowed to go out and with your friends into New York City?
No, so Wildwood was about 100 miles, about 80 miles from New York, so you couldn't, you didn't have enough time. Because you worked, most all of us worked 2 jobs.
So when did you
have
get
a day
a chance?
Off, huh?
When did you have a chance to get out there to New York City?
In 1960.
Oh, that was your first time
to
New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you do when you went to New York City?
I lived with a friend of mine in Harlem. They was a bunch of gangsters.
Really? What did y'all do?
They did everything.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You didn't do it with them?
No.
Yeah?
No, I always did my thing now. I choose what I want to do.
So you worked in Harlem?
Yeah.
Doing what?
We worked at a hospital. And I worked in shipping, where you get supplies for the floors, you know, syringes and anything you needed for the floor. I didn't like it.
You didn't like the work?
No, I think I didn't. Reason I didn't like it, the work, but then it was too many different nationalities. And by coming from the South, I wasn't used to working where Puerto Ricans were, Italian, you know, different blacks. And, you know, it was just too many different people worked at the hospital, and I couldn't adjust to it.
That's what I was going to ask you. How was it different from North Carolina for you? What else? I mean,
well, see, in the South, and you and I was talking in 1997. Mm-hmm. The South is still two people, black and white. You just start getting Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and Jews in this town. You know, this town just start integrating. See, people run around talking about integration. We just started integrating in the last 5 years. We all, you know, you talk about integration, we are black and white been integrated all their life. This county has just started integrating in the last 5 or 6 years. And that's when the Mexicans started moving in. And these industry bringing Jews and different nationalities.
So, you were in New York in 1960. It was a whole different thing for you. Did you like New York?
I like the fast lights. I like the lights, but I was with people won't go nowhere. You know, they just won't go nowhere. And I came back and went to school.
How long were you there?
1 year.
1 year, and you went back.
And then I worked Wildwood every summer.
Okay.
I'd go to school 91, 92, 93, 94.
No. I'm sorry, you were in school for 1 year. Right, is that what you were just saying?
Yeah, I went to college.
How long were you in New York before you went to school?
I stayed out of school 1 year, high school.
1 year, yeah. So 1 year you were away, mm-hmm. and you came back about 1961.
Yeah.
And where did you go to school?
Down at Kittredge Junior College.
Kittredge, and you were there for 1 year?
I was there for 2 years.
2 years.
And I used to work at a funeral home too. I used to like that.
Which funeral home?
It was called Shepherd Funeral Home up the street. I used to hang out there as a kid and pick up dead people and go to care people hospital and ask the telephone and stuff like that. That was exciting for me.
Shepherd Funeral Home? Mm-hmm. Is that they're related to the shepherds?
The same shepherds as in
same shepherds.
Yeah, Central North Carolina Central.
So they started a couple of businesses here in Oxford.
Oh yeah, yeah, black orphanage.
Right. So, what did you do after you left Kittredge?
I got drafted in '65. And went to service.
Right. Okay. So right out of college, you went into the service.
They drafted me.
Right.
I was bumming around. I wasn't trying to finish school.
What service was?
I went to Army. I was in a paratroop. I was in the 82nd.
In the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I get those things mixed up. So you were a paratrooper in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked a little bit about that and how it changed your life. What was it like serving in the Dominican Republic?
I thought that people live like dogs. I had lived in New York and Harlem, and they live worse than Harlem, you know. I felt sorry for everybody. And the first 2 weeks, it was hard for me to adjust, and then the guys that was coming back from Vietnam come there, and some of you go there and train, and then you go to Vietnam. And those guys have been in those war zones all the time, and they taught me if you want to live, you got to separate that out of your life and try to get back home. And that was hard for me to do, but I grew up fast and learned he was right. That you just, you know, if you can't feel sorry for those people, they going to kill you or you'll get killed. So you have to stay focused on how to live and how to get back. You want to get back home to your family. Because those people will cook and work for us during the day and shoot at us all night. That's what
really?
We would say, yeah.
Really? So it was the same people?
The same people. We always thought it was the same people. We was convinced that it was the same ones. And I always thinking, I had still always had that carryover from high school and moving around, always thinking about what people would do. and always didn't trust people because I came from the streets. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that they was the ones that would shoot at us.
Well, were they, during the daytime when they weren't shooting, were they friendly?
They were cook. They worked for us in a compound.
Did they seem to like the Americans or not?
Oh, yeah, they love you. They fool you because we give them everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you make any friends with any of them?
They would, but they didn't like for you. First sergeant, he was white. He didn't like for you to make friends with those people.
So what about being in the service in the 1960s? Did you encounter any discrimination?
Well, you did, but you know, I was born in it. So, you know, it don't bother you. You know, when we was in St. Louis, I was telling a guy, and we were stationed in Fort Leonard Wood. We had a town called Waynesville. It was just like the show you on TV where you make movies, you go to the town, all white people looking at you, like they're wearing guns and stuff like that, and you walk down this. It was like a plank row, like a movie. You walk like a saloon. You walk from one store to another store. It was crazy to me.
Where was this?
In Waynesville. It was out from St. Louis. Mm-hmm. It was out
like
between
Missouri.
St. Louis and Fort Leonard Wood. It wasn't but a hillbilly little town. And we went one time in with some white guys that was a station with us. And we went to town one day. And this white lady, white man, said he wasn't going to serve us or wasn't going to do this if we keep noise and got rowdy. So I think what he thought, all black people was noise and rowdy, which I guess soldiers are. But he let us know if we was going to do that, we was going to get kicked out or don't. He wasn't going to have it. Mm-hmm. And by me coming from the South and a white man going to tell me, and I thought, you know, once you left North Carolina, I didn't know it was everywhere. And so when he told me that, I said, wait a minute, I can adjust to that. I didn't know they had these kind of people everywhere. And so that day we stayed in town with those white guys. But the next time they said, come on, go to town, we tell them, no, it's better for us to stay on post. And every once in a while we would catch the buses to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Every other week, because I knew I would go to jail. See, I knew it right quick, you know, where to get off. You know, my friends, we was from the South. And we had to let those northern boys know that those white people's gonna kill you, man. Mm-hmm. Don't go down there.
So how was St. Louis?
It was wide open.
Yeah?
Yeah, time you get off the bus, it was wide open. I want nothing but a strip,
yeah.
Prostitutes and everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I went back about 15 years later, I want nothing left but the bus station. I looked for all that where I were. It was the stadium
changed.
Right downtown. They just gutted out all of that. Ran the blacks out of town.
That's
ran them over to East St. Louis somewhere.
Yeah.
Because when I was going that time, you get off the bus and one number strips and strips and strips. Plenty of black people. Mm-hmm. When I went back, won't no black people. They closed the town up at 6 or 6:30. Like, big, you know, you go out in the suburbs.
That's true. That's continued. My aunt lives there now. Same thing.
See, it was glass light square there. Mm. Did she ever tell you about the 50s?
She didn't tell me about
that.
I'll
yeah.
have to ask her.
If you could get up there. Yeah. We went to the movie. You had to go way uptown.
I have to try and get her to tell me a little bit about that. So, you were in the service for 2 years, from 65 to 67?
Uh-huh.
And then what did you do?
When I came out of service, I went back to Wildwood because I came out in February.
Wildwood, New Jersey?
Uh-huh. I needed money. And then after I worked that summer, was a friend guy that had left the year before. And he lived in New Haven, Connecticut, and wanted to know that I want to go to Connecticut and live with him. And then I went there, moved there in Thanksgiving of 67.
Oh, that's about the time I was born. You were moved into New Haven, Connecticut?
Yeah, you was born. You're that young. Oh, where? Yeah.
I'm not that young. But yeah, I was born in October of 67. So, and you stayed there for how long?
Almost 2 years. I worked for United Aircraft. They make airplane motors and engines. And I got hurt, and I had lived in New York. But I went to New York when I got out of service and went to Long Island. That's where I went.
Okay.
I went back because my friend had left Harlem and moved to Long Island. Mm-hmm. And I got hurt in the service jumping out of pinched nerve.
What was hurt exactly?
Who?
Was it your back?
Yeah.
Okay.
From jumping out of pinched nerve and my back pain. And I couldn't live in New York because the subways and the hustle, it was just killing me. And I thought if I went to Wildwood, I'd get rid of it. And I went there, and it didn't work. And then I went to Connecticut and tried to, it just got worse because the pain. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I had a back operation after that. I moved back south because I wasn't married.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you got back to North Carolina in
69.
Oh, 69. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know you didn't originally come back to Oxford.
No, I went to Raleigh.
You went to Raleigh.
And Durham.
And Durham.
Trying to adjust.
And then, were Raleigh and Durham much different from Oxford then?
Well, what happened was we had to leave town.
You had to leave what, Oxford?
Yeah.
Why?
See, I came back in 69. It was something like September 69.
Mm-hmm.
And in May of 70, a boy got killed.
Right, Henry Merrill.
Yeah.
So you were in Oxford when that happened?
Yeah.
You were living back
there. See, I came in September 69.
So you were back in Oxford that whole time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
okay.
See, and we had a lot of problems. And so I left town that May, that June.
Well, I've read Tim Tyson's thesis about that whole incident.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to know your side of the story. So
why you want to be curious about my side of the story?
Well, you were there, and it's a first-hand account. It's always better than reading it from someone else's interpretation. So you knew Henry Merrill, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long had you known him?
I knew his family. I knew him as a kid, see, because like I was older than he was. But I knew he had just come out to service. See, he had just come from Vietnam too. See, he had come from Vietnam. I think he must have got back somewhere around September, October mm-hmm. of 69 from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He had a wife and two kids.
Right.
And I knew of him.
You didn't hang around with him?
Oh, no. No.
What was he like?
He's a quiet guy.
He's a quiet guy.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, he was coming back from the service, you know, and he'd been gone, I think, 3 years.
Right.
You know, I didn't know how long he'd been back, but he was here.
What about Robert Till? Were you familiar with him?
I just knew he was a white man. I knew him and his son killed this boy. But I didn't want to care nothing about him. You know, he was white, it'd make him different than me.
Did you ever go to his store before the murder happened?
No, I knew he cut hair. And I might have stopped in there for a soda or something. Mm-hmm. That's about all. I knew it was a barber shop, a motorcycle shop, and a store. Mm-hmm. I'd Vegas stopped in there if I was on that side of town. You know, it wasn't a place where you'd want to stop. You know, you were just on that side of town, you were stopping.
So, what happened after Henry Merrill was shot?
After he was shot, it was three or four blacks were shot that night. Mm-hmm. And then we had a riot.
Shot by who?
By Till.
He shot three or four other blacks
mm-hmm.
in addition to Henry Merrill
mm-hmm.
that same night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
See, we had come out of the 60s with riots and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, I'd had experience with that stuff, see, Martin Luther King in 68 and all that stuff, you see. And here comes 70.
So there was a riot in Oxford in 1968 after King was killed?
Well, everybody left town. We went to Raleigh and Durham and other places where they were, you know, bigger cities. Because they was burning up Newark. They just burning up every city. That they got there, well, you know,
yeah, I heard,
burned
yeah.
up Detroit too. You
right.
was a kid, but they
yeah.
burned it up.
The summer before I was born, yeah.
Yeah.
So, was this the first time Oxford had this type of riot?
This magnitude.
Right.
They had experienced riot, mm-hmm. but not this big before.
So, were you one of the people that started the riot?
I never started nothing.
But you were there?
I participated mm-hmm. on everything, yeah. I was. Yeah.
So after that, I know there was the town got a little, the black community got organized, and Ben Chavis was involved in that.
Yeah.
As well. Right?
Yeah.
What was Ben Chavis like then?
He was a quiet guy. He said he was a school teacher. You
yeah.
know, he was. That's what they say. You know.
Did you know him?
Yeah, I knew him. Knew his mom. See, his father was a Boy Scout. He He was in charge of Boy Scout. He's the only black Boy Scout master I'd known, you know. He was in charge of Boy Scout. So all of us respected Mr. Chambers. Because I think he'd been in the service. He was a serviceman. We call him Major Chambers. That might have been his name, but we was in a Boy Scout. And he was a real good Boy Scout teacher. We learned a lot about ropes and about things like that. You know, it was amazing. Everybody that ran around me, that we always was into things, but we was in the Boy Scouts. And those A students, all those smart kids, wasn't Boy Scouts. That was amazing in this town. All street kids was Boy Scouts. I guess that's to keep us busy back then. We didn't know it, but Mr. Chay was keeping us busy and it worked. But that's who was in the Boy Scouts for street children.
Hmm. So were you and Ben about the same age?
Oh, no. No. Ben way younger than I am.
Oh, yeah.
I'm about 6 or 7 years old.
So he wasn't in Boy Scouts with you, right?
No. No. He was a choir boy. Hmm.
So when all this stuff started going on, the rioting, and residents were pretty upset, did you start attending the meetings of the church?